This is a reading of a collection of lectures by Rudolf Steiner entitled The Healing Process. This is Lecture 7, entitled What the Art of Healing Can Gain from the Spiritual Scientific Perspective, Number 1, given in Arnhem, July 17, 1924. The leadership of the Anthroposophical Society, having requested a course of lectures on educational subjects here in Arnhem, also decided that it would be appropriate for me to give a few public lectures on the relationship of anthroposophical spiritual science to the art of healing. I need to provide an introduction of sorts in tonight's lecture, however, so I will reserve the intended topic, How Anthroposophy Can Fructify the Art of Healing, for the next two lectures. To the great satisfaction of the organizers, many of you in the audience tonight are relatively unfamiliar with anthroposophy. Consequently, lectures dealing with a specialized field, such as medicine, would be left up in the air, so to speak, without an introductory lecture on general anthroposophy. Anthroposophy is not intended to be the fanatical sectarian movement it is often reputed to be. It intends to be a fully serious, scientific worldview that addresses the spiritual realm as earnestly as we now habitually apply scientific methods to the material realm. This focus on the spiritual realm may seem unscientific from the very beginning, because of the common and prevalent opinion that scientific understanding results only from sensory experience and its contributions to the human intellect. Many people believe that we must renounce science as soon as our focus shifts to the spiritual realm. They say that only subjective opinions and emotional mysticism, which are matters of individual choice, can decide spiritual issues, and that faith must take the place of scientific knowledge in this realm. My task in this introductory lecture will be to demonstrate that this is not the case. Admittedly, anthroposophy does not intend to be a science in the ordinary sense of the word, because science is typically conducted in isolation from everyday life by specially trained individuals. Anthroposophy intends to be a worldview that is relevant to anyone who longs to answer questions about the purpose and meaning of human life and the workings of spiritual and material forces in our existence, and wants to apply such insights to everyday life. Thus far, we have definitely succeeded in applying the anthroposophical view to very practical areas, especially in the field of education. We have established schools based on the perspectives that will be discussed here today. We have also had widely recognized success in the healing arts, as paradoxical as this may seem to many people today. Anthroposophy does not intend to oppose any recognized field of science or to foster trivial dilettantism. Serious seekers of anthroposophical insights are expected to respect and value the approach that has led to such great accomplishments in various scientific fields, especially in recent times. In the healing arts, therefore, it cannot be our intention to promote amateurish opposition to modern science. Rather, we intend to demonstrate how specific spiritual methods supplement our scientific knowledge with insights that can come only from broadening our field of research to include the spiritual world. Anthroposophy attempts to expand human knowledge by developing means of cognition that do not yet exist in ordinary life or in conventional science, where we apply the knowledge we acquire through our inherited human potentials and abilities, supplemented by what our conventional modern education provides as we grow into adulthood, in the present sense of the word. Anthroposophy intends to go further. It begins with what I would like to call intellectual modesty. Let me now describe this intellectual modesty that is the prerequisite to acquiring a sense of what anthroposophy is all about. Let's take a look at the earliest stages of child development. When children are born into the world, their expressions of life, and especially the contents of their souls, bear little resemblance to the facilities of will and cognition that enable adults to orient themselves in the world. Sorry, let me read that again. That sentence again, I made a mistake there. When children are born into the world, their expressions of life, and especially the contents of their souls, bear little resemblance to the faculties of will and cognition that enable adults to orient themselves in the world. These faculties are not fully mature at birth. They must be developed from the child's body and soul through education. We all agree that we cannot be truly effective as human beings if we do not develop and supplement our inherited capabilities through education. But sooner or later, depending on what degree of education we complete, we step out into adult life and are able to relate to it because we have achieved a certain awareness of the world around us. Those of us who understand Anthroposophy's intentions ask whether this childhood ability to change significantly as psychological characteristics unfold is also present in so-called adults. Even when we approach the sense-perceptible world with all the faculties instilled in us by the highest levels of modern formal education, don't we still possess latent soul capabilities that can be further developed? Why shouldn't we attain additional insights into how to conduct our practical affairs, insights that supplement and enhance what we have achieved in developing our ordinary state of consciousness? In Anthroposophy, therefore, we undertake a course of self-development that is intended to transcend our ordinary level of consciousness. The human soul has three capabilities that we develop to a certain extent for the sake of everyday life, but these capabilities can also be elaborated further. At our present stage of culture and civilization, only Anthroposophy urges us to extend our capacities for thinking, feeling, and willing in the appropriate way. All three can be transformed into cognitive faculties in a higher sense of the word. Let's consider thinking first. In modern formal education, our thinking submits passively to the world around us. The scientific approach actually requires us to minimize the internal activity of thinking to allow external, environmental factors to speak to us only as our senses describe them. In our thinking, we simply submit to sensory observation. It is said that any attempts to go beyond this passive relationship lead only to fantasizing and daydreaming. The efforts of Anthroposophy, however, lead to neither. On the contrary, they lead to inner activity that is as full of clarity as any accomplishments in mathematics or geometry. Anthroposophical efforts are patterned on those of mathematics or geometry, with the difference that the qualities they aim to develop are not specific, like those in geometry, but universally human, touching every human heart. Any sufficiently unbiased mind can grasp the initial results of such efforts. We simply apply our ability to think to something other than an external object. We allow a thought to be present in our souls, preferably a thought that we can survey in its totality, and devote ourselves to this one thought for a certain period of time. Let me describe this process more exactly. If you are trusting enough, you should approach someone with experience in this field and ask that person to recommend the best thought for you to devote yourself to in this way. The thought should be easy to survey. If possible, however, it should be new to you. An old and familiar thought will stir up all kinds of subjective memories and feelings in your soul, and you will fall into daydreaming very easily. In contrast, if you use a new thought that stirs up no memories, you will be able to devote yourself to it in a way that increasingly strengthens your soul's thought powers. In my books, especially titled How to Know Higher Worlds and titled An Outline of Esoteric Science, I call this inner method of cultivating thinking meditation, an old word that we will use here only in the sense that I am about to explain. Meditation consists of turning our attention away from anything we experience either outside or inside ourselves. We think only about a single thought that we have placed in the center of our soul activity. The effects on our soul forces, when we apply our entire soul strength to a single thought, is comparable to the effects of repeatedly practicing a physical gesture. The muscles grow stronger. The same thing happens with our soul forces. They grow stronger when we apply them repeatedly to a single thought over a longer period of time. In fact, it may not take such a long time, because the point is simply to learn to concentrate on a single thought. And what takes one person 3 years may take someone else only a week to accomplish. Through such exercises, performed repeatedly for 15 or even only 5 minutes a day, we begin to feel ourselves fill with new inner strength. Previously, we sensed the strength of our nerves in our ordinary thinking and feeling, and the strength of our muscles in picking up objects and carrying our out-routine tasks. We learn to feel this kind of strength as we grow out of childhood. Similarly, we also gradually learn to feel the new strength that fills us as we perform these thought exercises, which I can describe here only in general terms. They are described in greater detail in the books I just mentioned. One day we sense that we can no longer think about external objects as we previously did, and that we now possess a completely new soul power, resembling a much stronger, condensed form of thinking. Eventually we sense that this new form of thinking allows us to grasp the full reality of our own lifespan, of which we were formerly aware in only a very shadowy way. Our memory, which reaches back to a certain point in childhood, informs us about the earthly life we have been living since birth. Shadowy memories of past experiences rise out of the soul's undefined depths. Compare these shadowy memory pictures with the full-blooded intensity of our day-to-day experiences. When we take hold of our thinking, as I described, our memories cease to be shadowy. And if we go back in time in our own earthly life, we experience what we did 10 or 20 years ago with all the inner intensity of the original experience. But we do not experience it in the same way, through direct contact with objects and beings outside ourselves. Rather, we experience a spiritual extract of the original events. As paradoxical as it may sound today, this new type of experience can result in very clear images. Suddenly, as if in a mighty tableau or panorama, we see our entire life going back to birth. Instead of a mere temporal sequence of individual events, we experience a unified tableau of our life. Time becomes space. We confront our past experience, but not in the sense of ordinary memory. We confront it in the form of a more profound human entity, a second human being within the person we are in our ordinary state of consciousness. Ordinarily, we are aware only of the physical aspect of the human being, which is built up out of substances taken from the world around us. We constantly discard these substances and take in new ones. It is possible to state with a high degree of precision that within a period of 7 to 8 years, the material substance that forms our bodies is discarded and replaced with new substance. The matter present in us is transient. But by becoming aware of our own lifespan through the condensed thinking we have acquired, we become aware of an element that persists throughout our earthly life. This element builds up the human organism out of substances taken from outside. It also breaks the body down again. The latter process is what we survey in the form of a tableau of our life. This tableau is distinguishable from ordinary memory in yet another way. In ordinary memory, life's events seem to approach us from outside. We remember what a certain person did to us and what happened because of this event. In the tableau that appears as a result of condensed thinking, we get to know ourselves. We recognize ourselves as we really are. We see what we did to other people and how we related to events. This is an important difference, because by getting to know ourselves in this more intense way, we also begin to recognize the inner being that is involved in our growth forces and even in nourishing us. We recognize ourselves as the beings that build up and break down our own bodies. The essential point here is that by acquiring self-knowledge of this sort, we also learn something that no ordinary science or ordinary consciousness can teach us. I must admit that it is difficult for me to speak on this subject, because it sounds so foreign in comparison to anything the experts consider legitimate today. Nonetheless, there is truth in the experience that results from condensed thinking. This experience forces us to realize that the natural laws we learn about when we study physics and chemistry, or perhaps even earlier in elementary school, are valid only within the material world of our Earth. These laws which we are so justifiably proud of having discovered, do not apply when we move out into cosmic space. At this point, I want to emphasize expressly that Anthroposophy, far from indulging in any dilettantish, unsubstantiated opposition to the natural sciences, acknowledges these sciences to a greater extent than they themselves do. But although Anthroposophists take the natural sciences very seriously, acquiring inward, condensed thinking leads us to state that natural laws apply only on Earth. If you consider this statement in an unbiased way, it may not seem so implausible, because in fact it is only apparently paradoxical. When we consider a source of light, we know that the intensity of the light decreases as it is dispersed. The farther we go from the source, the weaker the light becomes, until we speak of twilight rather than light. Ultimately, if we go far enough, we no longer think of it as light at all. The same is true of natural laws. They are fully valid in the earthly realm, but as we go further out into the cosmos, they become less and less valid, until ultimately they no longer apply at all. The laws we learn about through condensed thinking, however, are at work in our own lives. They show us that we, human beings, are not born out of the Earth's natural laws, but out of higher cosmic laws. We bring these higher laws with us when we enter earthly existence. Thus, as soon as we grasp the condensed form of thinking, we realize that natural laws apply only to the Earth's mineral kingdom, a very understandable error on the part of modern physics suggests that they also apply to the sun and the stars, but that is impossible, because attempting to apply natural laws to the whole universe is like trying to illuminate it with a single candle flame. When we ascend from the level of minerals, and only on Earth are they mineral in the sense in which we know them here, to the level of life, we can no longer speak of natural laws that apply to the Earth. Instead, we must speak of laws that work into earthly existence from the universe, from cosmic space. This is already true of plants. The laws of Earth, such as gravity and other forces that work from the center toward the periphery, can be used only to explain minerals. When we move up to the level of plant existence, we are forced to realize that the sphere of the Earth is now the center, and that the laws of life work in on it from all directions, from the cosmos. These laws of life are also the laws we discover within ourselves as a result of condensed thinking, and the laws that allow us to build up our own bodies between birth and death. In addition to laws that work outward from the center of the Earth, we learn to recognize those that work in from all directions toward the center. Laws of the latter type are at work in all living beings, beginning with the plant kingdom. We know that a plant springing up out of the earth contains mineral substances. Today's chemistry has made great progress in understanding how these substances interact, and it will continue to learn more. This chemical information is all well and good, all totally justified. But if we want to explain the existence of a plant, we must explain how it grows. And growth cannot be explained in terms of forces that work upward out of the earth. It can be explained only by forces that work into earthly existence from the periphery, from the cosmos. We are forced to acknowledge that we must advance from the earthly perspective to the cosmic perspective. That includes true human self-knowledge. We can continue to progress in our self-development by transforming feeling as well as thinking. In ordinary life, our feelings are a personal affair rather than a real source of insight. Our ordinary, purely subjective feeling experience, however, can also be transformed into a true source of objective knowledge. It happens in the following way. In meditation, we concentrate on a very specific thought. The result is condensed thinking, which allows us to understand the laws that work from the cosmic periphery toward the center of the earth, in contrast to the ordinary natural laws that work outward in all directions from the earth's center. When we have acquired condensed thinking and have learned to see both our own life and the life of plants spread out before our souls, as if in a mighty tableau, we can go still further. Once this newly forceful thinking has taken hold, we can then eliminate the strengthened thought. If you know how difficult it is in ordinary life to eliminate a thought that has taken hold of you, you will understand why special exercises are necessary to accomplish what I just mentioned. It is possible, however, to use your soul's entire strength to eliminate not only the thought you have been concentrating on, but also the entire memory tableau, thus withdrawing your attention entirely from your own life. Once you have done so, you will clearly notice that you are descending deeper into your own soul and entering regions that are otherwise accessible only to feeling. When we eliminate impressions of sight, sound, and so on in everyday life, we generally fall asleep. Once we have developed condensed thinking, however, we no longer fall asleep when we eliminate all thoughts, even condensed thoughts, from our consciousness. Instead, we enter a state in which no sense impressions and no thoughts are active. Although we are fully awake and not sleeping, our consciousness is empty. This state of empty but wakeful consciousness is discovered through spiritual scientific methods and can be systematically and methodically developed in any human being. Ordinarily, when we empty our consciousness, we fall asleep with respect to our ordinary life. From the time we fall asleep to the time we wake up, our consciousness is empty, but we are asleep. To be awake with empty consciousness is the second cognitive state anthroposophy strives to achieve. Our consciousness does not remain empty for long, however. Ordinary consciousness fills with colors and sounds through seeing and hearing, and our newly emptied consciousness begins to fill with a spiritual world that surrounds it just as the ordinary physical world surrounds ordinary consciousness. Only an empty consciousness can discover the spiritual world, which comprises the most profound aspect of our being, although it exists neither on earth nor in cosmic space, but outside space and time. Earlier, the consciousness that condensed thinking supplies taught us to see the entirety of our own lifespan. But now we learn to use our empty consciousness to look out into the world where we led a soul's spiritual existence before descending into earthly existence. We learn to recognize ourselves as beings that exist on a spiritual level before conception and birth, as soul-spiritual human beings whose bodies are supplied by our parents and more distant ancestors. As I said earlier, the physical body's substance is exchanged every 7 years, but a person's true being comes from pre-earthly life. We cannot learn this through theories or through fanciful musings. We learn it only when intellectual modesty allows us to develop the appropriate capabilities. In this way, we each come to know our inner soul spiritual being. This being comes to meet us when both feeling and cognition are active as we descend into the feeling realm. We must note, however, that achieving this level of cognition is bound up with intense inner experiences that can be described as follows. If you are unable to move a certain part of your physical organism, for instance, if someone ties two of your fingers together, the experience is unpleasant and perhaps even painful. Now, however, you exist in a state of soul spiritual experience without the participation of the body. Since you now live with an empty consciousness, you are not in full possession of your physical body. The transition to this state is associated with a profound feeling of pain. By experiencing this pain and renunciation, you enter your own most profound soul-spiritual nature. Many people draw back from this experience in fear, but it is the only way to learn about your true human nature. Having recognized your innermost being in this way, you can then go still further by learning to develop a cognitive power that is not usually seen as such in everyday life. You must develop love into a cognitive power by entering selflessly into the world's objects and events, by cultivating love until you can actually transport yourself into a body-free state of looking at the world. You learn to understand yourself completely as a spiritual being in the spiritual world. You know what it means to be a human spirit. But you also know the meaning of death, because at death we lay aside the physical body. In this third form of cognition, which we experience by deepening our ability to love, we separate from the physical body and learn to recognize ourselves as independent of it. From this moment on, we know what it means to lay aside the earthly body and pass through the gate of death. We become familiar not only with death, but also with life after death in the soul spiritual realm. We each learn to recognize our soul spiritual being as it will be in life after death. Previously, we learned to recognize this being as it exists in the spiritual world before descending into earthly existence. But now we understand the life of the soul spiritual human being after death. At this point, we become aware of how incomplete and imperfect our modern consciousness is. At that level of consciousness, we speak of immortality, or the afterlife, as a matter of hope and faith. But immortality, our continued existence, from the present point in time onward, is only half of eternity. Earlier stages of knowledge still had words for the unborn, pre-birth state that constitutes eternity's other half, but we do not. Human beings are not only immortal, however, but also unborn. That is, we enter physical existence by being born out of the spiritual world, just as we enter spiritual existence again when we leave the physical world at death. We understand the human being as a totality only by learning that the true spiritual human being passes through birth and death. What I have described here so briefly and in such general terms is the subject of an extensive literature that is as conscientious in its approach and as responsible for the information it supplies as the most exact science that can exist today. We have touched on a spiritual science that truly intends to be a match for conventional science. Spiritual science teaches us that life includes two opposing tendencies. We are aware of the burgeoning power of life and are accustomed to speaking of life's developmental tendency. We speak of how a small child develops and grows and of the evolution of lower life forms into higher ones as life becomes ever more complex. Inner development, however, teaches us that this generative and regenerative tendency contrasts and coexists with a degenerative tendency in any sentient being. Both rampant, sprouting, generative life and declining, degenerative life are present in us. The mode of cognition that I have described reveals that life does not simply extend into our brain and nervous system, arranging the material element to permit the nervous system to support our soul life. That is not the case. Life sprouts and burgeons, but it also constantly declines and disintegrates in us. Sprouting, burgeoning life continually makes way for decline. We undergo a partial death at every moment. There is always something falling apart in us. We simply build it up again. But wherever the material aspect falls apart, the soul, spiritual aspect has room to enter and become active in us. At this point, we encounter materialism's greatest error, the idea that in humans, sprouting, burgeoning life continues to evolve into the nerves themselves, and that nerves are generated out of the blood, just as muscles are. This view is correct as far as it goes, but building up nerves does not develop thinking or feeling. Thinking and feeling develop when the nerves fall apart and become full of holes, figuratively speaking. At that point, the soul's spiritual aspect is drawn into the matter that is falling apart. If we are to experience the emergence of our soul's spiritual aspect, the material aspect must first be broken down. Natural science, if correctly conceived, will take a major step when it recognizes the opposite and complement of development in the appropriate place. Science must acknowledge degeneration as well as generation and regeneration, devolution as well as evolution. When this happens, we will understand how the spiritual element takes hold of matter in animals and humans. Human beings are conscious of this process, while animals are not. The material element does not evolve into spirit. Rather, when matter breaks down in a reversal of its original process, spirit takes hold of it. When matter breaks down, spirit can manifest. We are filled with spirit. It is present wherever devolution, de-evolution, occurs instead of evolution. Thus, we learn to see that the human being as a whole exists in a polarity of opposites. In any organism where generation and regeneration take place, degeneration must also be present. Degeneration and regeneration are in constant flux in any organ we look at, whether liver, lungs, or heart. Isn't it a strange figure of speech, for example, when we say, quote, "the Rhine is flowing there," close quote? What is the Rhine? When we look at it, we usually have the flowing water in mind, not the riverbed. But the flowing water is never the same from one moment to the next, although the Rhine has been there for hundreds and thousands of years. What is the same at any given moment? The changing flow. Similarly, everything inside us is in a constant state of flux between degeneration and regeneration. Degeneration provides a vehicle for the spiritual element. In every normal human life, degeneration and regeneration are in balance, and our real soul spiritual capacities develop in this state of balance. The balance can be disturbed, however, when an organ grows rampantly because it fails to counter its unique degree of regeneration with enough degeneration. Or the opposite can occur. An organ fails to counter a normal degree of degeneration with enough regeneration. A physiological phenomenon becomes pathological, and the organ atrophies and dries up. We need to comprehend this state of balance in order to understand how it is disturbed by excessive degeneration or regeneration. Having understood such disturbances, however, we can widen our view to include the whole wide world and discover the external, natural process that can counteract disturbed degeneration or regeneration. For example, if we consider first a human organ that is disturbed as a result of excessive degeneration, and then turn our attention, sharpened by spiritual scientific insight, to a plant as it appears in nature, we can recognize the regenerative process in that particular plant. It becomes evident that certain species of plants always contain regenerative forces that correspond exactly to the regenerative forces in human organs. According to the general view I have just explained, we can discover that regenerative forces are always present in the human kidneys. Let's assume that these forces are too weak and are overwhelmed by degenerative forces. Looking around in the plant world, we perceive that the common scouring rush, Equisetum arvensa, contains regenerative forces that correspond exactly to those in our own kidneys. We prepare a remedy from Equisetum. In the appropriate way, through the circulation and through digestion, we bring it into contact with the organ it is intended to affect. This remedy strengthens the kidney's weakened regenerative forces. Similar remedies can be developed for other organs. Once we have acquired the basic insight, we can use forces we find in the world outside ourselves to re-establish the balance between degeneration and regeneration in human organs. Whenever we discern regenerative forces that are too strong and degenerative forces that are too weak, whether in the kidneys or in other organs, we must strengthen the degenerative process with remedies derived from primitive fern-like plants. In this way, we can get beyond mere experimentation and testing of the efficacy of substances or remedies. The art of medicine becomes comprehensible when we understand the human body on the basis of the state of balance in its organs and the natural world on the basis of forces of regeneration and degeneration. We do not simply administer a remedy because statistics show that it has a beneficial effect in a certain number of cases. Instead, through our understanding of nature and the human being, we know exactly how to transform the process, active in a natural product, into a remedy that supports a human organ's regenerative or degenerative forces. I am not saying that medicine has not made tremendous progress in recent times. Anthroposophy fully acknowledges this progress and does not exclude modern medicine. On the contrary, our work validates it fully. But when we investigate recently developed remedies that are truly effective, we find that they have all been discovered only through luck and a long, slow process of experimentation. Anthroposophy provides clear insight into these lucky discoveries, which are fully confirmed by our insight into human nature. In addition, however, anthroposophy offers a whole series of new remedies discovered by directly applying our insight into nature and the human being. When we learn this method of spiritual insight into the human being, and I will still demonstrate how individual areas of medicine can be fructified by truly acknowledging the spirit, and begin to see spiritual life in addition to material life, we unite insight and medicine rationally and precisely, rather than in the ancient dream-filled way that found its outlet in mythology. A truly artistic view of the world teaches us the art of healing. Through modern methods of inner development, which cannot be the same as ancient ones now that we have the accomplishments of science behind us, we again achieve an insight that was once available through a dreamlike kind of cognition. Such insight teaches us how to apply the forces of nature and spirit to healthy and sick human beings, to the healthy in the education of children and adults, and to the sick in the art of medicine. In ancient times, centers of healing were associated with mystery centers that cultivated a knowledge intended to answer people's religious questions and satisfy their soul's longings. Today the methods of ancient healing centers seem childish to us, and rightly so, but they did contain a healthy kernel of truth, namely that our understanding of the so-called normal world needs to continue into the abnormal world. Isn't it strange to say that it is natural for human beings to be healthy while we are also forced to explain human illness on the basis of natural laws? For it is true that natural laws can explain every illness. Is nature contradicting itself here? We will see that human illness is not a contradiction in nature. We must simply maintain our understanding of the physically normal as we move into the domain of pathological conditions. This understanding gains real value for our life only when centers that care for the sick are found alongside centers that care for the normal. Admittedly, anthroposophy is now only in the early stages of such undertakings, but we are making progress toward goals that any unbiased mind will find justified. The Goetheanum in Dornach, which unfortunately burned down but will soon be rebuilt, we hope, was to be a center for the knowledge that satisfies our human longing to understand clearly the sources of our life. It was a matter of course for us that this Goetheanum would be associated with clinics that implement in some modest way a true understanding of the human being. The first of these clinics was the Clinical Therapeutic Institute in Arlesheim, which resulted from the efforts of Dr. Ita Wegmann. It was followed by the Institute, headed by Dr. Zeilmans von Emmichoven, in The Hague. Thus in Dornach, a center of healing has once again been established in association with a center of understanding. Recognizing the spirit always requires courage, especially with regard to healing. This courage to heal, which enables us to master holistic forces of healing and apply them for the benefit of humanity, is alive and well in the Clinical Therapeutic Institute in Arlesheim, which is associated with the Goetheanum. It is appropriate that the Goetheanum is a center of knowledge that aspires to the mysteries in the modern sense, attempting to nurture both the great and the detailed issues of life, is associated with a therapeutic center that is trying to deepen the art of healing spiritually, especially since the manifestation on a deeper level of what has been fostered in Dornach since last Christmas. Footnote: during Christmas 1923, the Anthroposophical Society was reestablished and revitalized after a series of setbacks, including the destruction of the original Goetheanum. For a detailed description of these events, see title The Christmas Conference for the Foundation of the General Anthroposophical Society, 1923-24. And I also have recorded that on this website. End of footnote. I have described the current connection between anthroposophy and medicine. This connection is expressed in the devoted work of my dear colleague, Dr. Ita Wegmann, whose decades-long involvement in anthroposophy, from its very beginnings, made our expansion into the art of healing almost inevitable. The spatial proximity of our center of knowledge and the therapeutic center provides an outer image of the intimate connection between anthroposophical insight and our practice of healing, which is directly derived from an understanding of the sick human being acquired through spiritual methods. Diagnosis and healing are not meant to go their separate ways. The diagnostic process is meant to extend into the healing process. By basing each diagnosis on insight into the processes that take place in disease states in human beings, anthroposophy attempts to see simultaneously the comparable degenerative or regenerative activities in the natural world. We recognize where degenerative forces are at work in nature and use them in remedies that counteract regenerative processes in the human being, and vice versa. Thus, a clear understanding of what is happening in a diseased human being also provides insight into the fundamental character of the remedy's effect. The next two lectures will discuss the results of the close association between our spiritual and clinical centers. This association deepens our inner understanding of the healthy or sick human being and enriches the modern art of healing. Today I chose to discuss only the character of spiritual insight and the thorough and intimate understanding of the human being that it affords, teaching us not only to approach natural and spiritual forces on a theoretical level, but also to manipulate them to shape our lives, whether in sickness or in health. As civilization progresses, life becomes ever more complicated. In the depths of our souls, many of us already long for means of coping with life's growing complexity. Anthroposophy's primary aim is to respond to this longing. We will see that anthroposophy, in contrast to many destructive impulses in modern life, chooses to work constructively to help our civilization grow and thrive. Our work involves real action directed toward life's practical issues rather than mere empty phrases. Anthroposophy aims for insight into the phenomena of modern life, insight that can be applied in helpful ways wherever it is needed. The end of Lecture 7.